the headlines. Iran marks National Persian Gulf Day, saying the waterway is an important part of the undeniable identity of the country and the region. Sudan's warring sides agreed to extend a temporary truce for another 72 hours while accusing each other of ceasefire violations. Also coming up, a British anti-monarchy group describes the call for public allegiance to King Charles III as offensive and the contempt of the people. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story this hour, Iran's foreign minister says receiving maximum benefits from the Persian Gulf hinges on convergence and cooperation among its littoral states. In a Twitter post, Hossein Emir Abdullahian further said that the Persian Gulf security should be ensured so that its littoral states would enjoy its benefits. He called the strategic water an important part of the indisputable identity of Iran and the region. The top Iranian diplomat made the remarks on National Persian Gulf Day. Iran has time and again rejected the presence of foreign forces in the Persian Gulf, saying its littoral states can themselves guarantee the security of the body of water.
Ancient maps and antique atlases on view. Collection of maps that date back to 500 BC illustrates how the name of the Persian Gulf has stayed the same through the ages.
One of the most important issues in Iranology is the names of different parts of Iran and how they have changed since antiquity. And the name of the Persian Gulf is also part of our studies and among the most important topics of research. As you can see in all of these historic maps that date back to 500 BC, many names have changed, but the name of the Persian Gulf, or Sinus Persicus, has remained the same.
This extensive collection of 200 ancient maps and atlases was recently archived by the Iranology Foundation. On the occasion of National Persian Gulf Day, the foundation curated this public exhibition not just for enthusiasts and researchers, but also for the education of the younger generation.
On the occasion of Persian Gulf Day, we decided to share our maps and atlases that contain a treasure trove of information about Iran and the Persian Gulf. We've invited university students and researchers, and we've also held workshops to inform visitors about the region, its name, and the culture of its peoples.
All the maps pertaining to the Islamic Golden Age refer to the body of water in the south of Iran as Sinus Persicus, or the Persian Gulf. The name even appears in the oldest map here, a copy of Claudius Ptolemy's world map, based on the description contained in his Book of Geography, one of the earliest surviving manuscripts.
April 30th, which is National Persian Gulf Day on the Iranian calendar, is a reminder that the country is steadfast in protecting its interests, and it will also stand firm against any threats to its sovereignty. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
In Sudan, the army and the rival paramilitary Rapid Support Forces have announced the extension of a truce they have largely violated as sporadic fighting continued on the ground. The latest widely breached ceasefire was scheduled to formally expire at midnight on Sunday, but the two sides announced an extension for another 72 hours. Sudan's rival military forces accused each other of fresh violations of the ceasefire. This comes as fighting in the capital Khartoum and other parts of the country entered its third week. More than 500 people have been killed since the start of the street battles on April 15th. Clashes erupted after weeks of tensions over the proposed integration of the paramilitary group into the African country's regular army. Security analyst Fidel Amaki Owusu earlier joined us to give his take on where the crisis in Sudan is heading.
This conflict was not so unexpected, but it has happened and it has shocked the region and the entire world. Now, the rate at which it is escalating, of course, analysts have said that this is going to degenerate into something monumental and something very, very dangerous and serious for the region and the entire continent, and even across the Red Sea into West Asia. Credibility is a big question because, 500 people are dead, and more than that are likely missing, and the situation has degenerated. Countries are evacuating their citizens.
An Israeli court has rejected another plea to release Palestinian hunger-striking inmate Sheikh Ghadir Adnan on bail despite his worsening health condition. Adnan's wife said the court has set another hearing for May 10, adding that her husband's health condition is very critical due to his prolonged hunger strike. Adnan started his hunger strike in early February. He has been brought before Israeli courts several times without an indictment. An Israeli prosecution authority has filed an official request asking for his detention for 5 years. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has warned that the 45-year-old inmate could die any moment. The Palestinian prisoner refuses to take any kind of medication or even undergo medical tests in protest against his detention. Moving on, a UK anti-monarchy group has branded as offensive calls by the Archbishop of Canterbury on Britons to swear allegiance to King Charles III. The group known as Republic, which is campaigning for the abolition of the British monarchy, said the allegiance call holds the people in contempt. It added, in a democracy, it is the head of state who should be swearing allegiance to the people, not the other way around. The group plans to hold a demonstration on Saturday. The office of the Archbishop of Canterbury has called on all people in the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland and all of the other realms and territories to make their homage to the King. The formal coronation of Charles is set to start on May 6. It is predicted that the ceremony will cost tens of millions of pounds, and it falls to taxpayers to foot the bill. Tensions remain high on the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang censures a recent agreement between Washington and Seoul to ramp up the deployment of U.S. nuclear resources to the region. North Korea says the deal between the two allies would escalate tensions to, quote, the brink of a nuclear war. It says positioning American strategic assets is aimed at building what it calls aggressive and exclusive military bloc in the region. Pyongyang also says the agreement shows the allies' willingness to take the most hostile and aggressive action against it. Last week, the U.S. and South Korean presidents struck a deal at the White House that allows the periodic deployment of American nuclear submarines to South Korea. Washington also vowed to give Seoul more insight into its nuclear planning over any conflict with its northern neighbor. The Iraqi president visited Tehran on Saturday in an effort to enhance bilateral relations between Baghdad and Tehran. President Abdel Latif Rashid met with a number of Iranian officials, including leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei and President Ibrahim Raisi. Enhancing economic relations and regional security were the main focus of the talks between officials of the two countries.
On a first official visit to the Islamic Republic since taking office, Iraqi President Abdel Latif Rashid has visited Tehran to hold talks with Iranian high-ranking authorities. Upon arrival, the Iraqi leader met with President Ebrahim Raisi at the Saadabad complex, where he received an official welcome by the Iranian top executive official. The two sides then held a joint press conference, with boosting bilateral relations between Tehran and Baghdad being the focus of their remarks.
With regards to political, trade and economic issues, as well as the cultural domain, we have so far had good relations in those areas, and both countries are set to further expand their mutual relations.
So it's clear and is a reality that relations between Iran and Iraq are constant and solid and unchangeable.
But enhancing trade relations and economic development was not the only issue discussed between the two presidents. President Raisi and the Iraqi leader also addressed issues concerning regional security.
A security agreement was reached between the two countries, and the slightest insecurity anywhere in Iraq is regarded as insecurity for Iran. So the security of Iraq is very important for us. The security of borders is important to us, and the security arrangements between the two countries can lead not only to the security of both countries, but the security of the whole region.
For his part, the Iraqi leader praised the role of Tehran in providing assistance to the Iraqi people during the rule of former dictator Saddam Hussein and at a time when the Arab country was gripped with foreign-backed terrorism by the Daesh terror group. The presence of foreign forces was also among issues discussed by the two presidents. President Raisi said, "As much as we consider useful the negotiations between the regional countries, we do not consider the presence of foreign forces in the region to be useful, and we regard the presence of Americans as a threat to the security of the region." Raisi said Iran's ties with Iraq and other countries of the region are based on common interests, but Americans only think of their own interests. Later on Saturday, the Iraqi president also met with the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. During the meeting, the leader called on Baghdad to get U.S. troops out of the Arab country, saying even one American soldier on the Iraqi soil is too many. Ayatollah Khamenei said the U.S. is not a friend of Iraq, adding that Washington is not even loyal to its European allies.
Iran's president says the level of trade between the two neighboring countries exceeds $10 billion and there is capacity to increase that figure. Tehran and Baghdad are also determined to expand their relations in other areas, including security. Iraqi officials have repeatedly hailed Iran for assisting Iraq during its fight against terror.
The visit by the Iraqi leader to Tehran is of very high significance, both concerning Iraq internal problems and regional and international issues. At a national level, the visit comes at a time when, according to Iran's president, the level of commercial and economic ties between the two countries exceed $10 billion. Not to mention that this figure can upgrade to a much higher level. According to President Raisi, relations between the two countries continue in various fields, including infrastructure, water, electricity, gas, and energy. These are the sectors that Iraq has been suffering the most from during the past couple of decades or so. That especially comes to the spotlight at a time when Iraq is trying to rebuild itself following its 23 U.S. invasion and the eradication of Daesh terrorists from the Arab country. The boosting of economic relations between Tehran and Baghdad not only will bring these two nations closer to each other, it would also help Iraq stand on its own feet after the U.S.-led war and occupation. This will also preserve the sovereignty of Iraq, given that the country has managed to be among those who have exempted themselves from the U.S. sanction measures on the Islamic Republic by continuing its trade with Tehran. After all, Iran plays a great role in developing the Iraqi infrastructure, and the presence of the Iraqi high-level delegation in Tehran can be an indication of that. In a broader perspective, Iraq has been hosting five rounds of negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and along with China, has facilitated the recent rapprochement between Tehran and Riyadh. That is something that would undeniably contribute to security and stability in the region. At an international level, it's not hidden to anyone that the West, namely the United States and its allies, have for decades been sowing discord and division among nations in the West Asia region to fulfill their own political and economic interests. Maybe that's exactly why these West Asian nations have come to an understanding that they should form a coalition and stand in the face of the West and its agenda, which merely aims to divide and conquer.
Elsewhere, as hunger continues to hit more and more people in Afghanistan, the UN Food Programme is urging donors to restore funding for economic relief in the war-ravaged country. Afghan households are also awaiting the flow of aid amid economic and political crises. Rahmatullah Baghban is in Kabul.
People in Afghanistan are facing desperation as hunger worsens and donations drop. According to the UN, 34 million Afghans are living in poverty, and over 6 million people are just one step away from famine. Heads of households like Boss Muhammad are struggling to feed their children without any aid in sight.
Our conditions are so difficult to bear. There are 10 of us in our family, but I can hardly make a meal every day. Our children should eat waste food and dried bread. I polish shoes, but the money I make goes to loans and rent. If this trend continues, I'm worried that my children will succumb to famine.
The UN Food Agency says it urgently needs $900 million for the next 6 months to help people in need in Afghanistan. And food aid has become a lifeline for millions amid unemployment and a lack of income.
We need help to survive. Our children, youth and elderly are gripped by hunger. The Taliban and the world should save us from all these disasters. We have no jobs to earn a living. I don't know what to do and where our next meal will come from.
Afghan experts say one of the main causes of the current situation is Western sanctions and the freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. and its allies, following the Taliban takeover in August 2021.
The root causes of the current situation are the U.S. sanctions and the freezing of Afghan assets following the political change in the country. These factors have triggered a banking and financial crisis that has crippled the economy, resulted in displacements, caused inflation and unemployment, and reduced access to basic services and goods.
Afghanistan has been teetering on the brink of famine and economic collapse since the Taliban took power in 2021, after 20 years of U.S. war and occupation. Afghan people are facing a bleak future until urgent action is taken to end their suffering. As experts say, lifting sanctions and unfreezing Afghan assets are necessary for people's well-being and survival. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thank you for staying tuned.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. in the limelight. In Britain, the government has offered teachers a £1,000 one-off payment alongside an average 4.5% pay rise next year. But this has been firmly rejected by all four teaching unions. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. Schools across England could be forced to close after four teaching unions announced coordinated strike action in a long-running dispute over pay. It means teachers and school leaders could stage walkouts at the same time, causing widespread disruption. The National Association of Head Teachers will re-ballot its members in England during the summer term on strike action, with possible walkouts in the autumn if the ballot is successful. It comes as teacher members of the National Education Union, NEU, staged fresh strikes in schools and sixth form colleges across England on Thursday, 27th of April, with another national walkout planned for next Tuesday. The National Education Union, NEU, will re-ballot its teacher members in England in a bid to take further industrial action in the autumn, and teachers in England represented by the NSUWT union will be re-balloted on strike action. The Association of School and College Leaders, ASCL, is also due to hold a formal ballot for national strike action in England for the first time in its history. The government offered teachers a £1,000 one-off payment for the current school year, 2022-2023, and an average of 4.5% pay rise for staff next year following intensive talks with the education unions. But all four education unions, the NAHT, the National Education Union, NEU, and the NASUWT, and the ASCL, all rejected the pay offer. The decision on teachers' pay in England for next year has been passed to the Independent Pay Review Body, the School Teachers Review Body, STRB. The General Secretaries of the four unions are due to announce that they intend to coordinate any industrial action moving forward at a press conference at the NAHT's annual conference in Telford on Friday afternoon, 28th of April. Paul Whiteman, the General Secretary of the NAHT, said, "This is an unprecedented show of solidarity from the education unions. It sends a clear signal to the British government that our dispute is not going away. Any illusions they may have had that we would be put off by their derisory first offer and refusal to continue to negotiate should be shattered. School staff will not put up with eroded pay, squeezed school funding and unbearable workload and working conditions any longer. And we are fully united together in fighting for change." Kevin Courtney, the Joint General Secretary of the National Education Union, NEU, said, "In washing her hands off any responsibility for resolving the teacher pay and funding dispute, the Education Secretary, Gillian Keegan, has united the teaching profession in its determination to not accept the poor offer currently on the table." Kevin Courtney added, "Parents and the education profession will be in no doubt that if further industrial action needs to be taken, the blame for all of this will squarely lie at the door of the British government."
The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. All state schools in England could be closed by unprecedented coordinated strikes involving all four teaching unions after their leaders vowed to increase pressure on the government to improve its pay offer. In a joint press conference, the leaders of the four major education unions said they wanted to send a clear message to the Education Secretary, Gillian Keegan, that she needed to resume negotiations over pay and school funding. The significance of four union general secretaries being aligned in this way should not be understated. It's a real demonstration of unity on our part and determination on the part of our members after weeks, if not months, of stonewalling from the Education Secretary Gillian Keegan, said Patrick Roach, the General Secretary of the NAS UWT. Patrick Roach said Education Secretary Gillian Keegan had gone to the ground and was refusing to meet the unions. Her haste to strike a deal has seriously backfired, and we're here today because it has galvanised not just us, but our members, rank and file, classroom teachers and school leaders who are now going to be balloted for industrial action. Jeff Barton, General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders, ASCL, said the government was in a parallel universe, describing the previous pay talks as bizarre and surreal. The nation's parents are watching on and saying, why is the government not sorting this out? This is a government that wants education on the cheap. They don't want to pay teachers, Jeff Barton said. If the ballots held by the four education unions, including the National Education Union, NEU, and the National Association of Head Teachers, the NAHT, passed the legal threshold, then the leader said they would coordinate industrial action in the autumn term this year. Kevin Courtney, Joint General Secretary of the National Education Union, NEU, said, I think with our four unions, you would find that every state school in England would be affected by the dispute, and that would put it up to 300,000 to 400,000 teachers who would be involved in taking industrial action. In March, the government offered teachers a £1,000 one-off payment alongside an average 4.5% pay rise next year after talks. But members of all the four education unions rejected the pay offer by the government by substantial margins. On Friday, 28th of April, the National Association of Head Teachers, the NAHT, announced it would again ballot its members for strike action. The union held a vote last year, but narrowly failed to suppress the 50% participation rate required by law, with union officials blaming the postal strike for members being unable to receive their ballot papers. We've been on this cliff edge for too long, and enough is enough, Paul Whiteman, the NAHT's General Secretary, said at his conference on Friday, 28th of April, as delegates voted to endorse a ballot. When it comes to school funding, the government has attempted to fob off the general public with massage figures and deceptive statistics, but it doesn't matter if you've been made to study maths until the age of 18 or the age of 180. Its sums just don't add up. The National Education Union, the NEU, gave notice that it would open balloting from Monday for renewed authorisation to hold strikes until the end of the year. So far, the NEU has held 5 days of national and regional strikes in England, with a further national strike planned for next Tuesday. Dr. Mary Boosted, the NEU's Joint General Secretary, accused Education Secretary Gillian Keegan of washing her hands over the teachers' pay dispute by refusing to reopen talks. The Secretary of State, who remains by some distance the biggest obstacle to getting a sensible resolution of this dispute, needs to address this issue head on and come to the negotiating table with all the education unions. This willful lack of engagement will be something that parents and teachers will not forget, Mary Boosted said. Britain's Education Secretary Gillian Keegan has refused to reopen talks, saying she will wait until she receives recommendations from the Independent School Teachers Review Body for a 2023-2024 pay award later on this summer.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program of Viewpoint, and I'm Beta, the host of today's episode. And we have two dear speaker guests here with me, Brother Ali and Brother Muhammad. Welcome. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So in this episode of today, we're going to discuss one of the most controversial issues of Islamic world about Palestinian issue. What could be the goal of Israel to, make alliance with these countries, Brother Muhammad?
What they're after with recognition is that they're trying to give themselves some genuinity and legitimacy for their own government, for their occupation. Once, for example, let's say at least half or more than half the world says, okay, this is a government that we recognize, then they will feel or they'll know that they have reached at least a part of their goal, which is occupying a small territory. And then slowly they want to expand.
Yeah.
Now, with when it comes to the Arab countries, you see, you have to bifurcate and to make a difference between the people and the government. You see, most of the Arab people and the Muslims, I should not only confine it to the Arabs because it's a matter that encompasses all the Muslims. And even countries like Malaysia and Indonesia and many of these Muslim countries are completely against Israel, right? So considering this, you need to make a difference between the governments and the people themselves.
Yeah.
The governments, normally what Israel does, it's a very cunning thing it does. It lobbies in the governments, it buys the people in the government, right? And then gives itself legitimacy this way, which is, you know, a very cunning way in doing so, but then it doesn't last. Why? Because government without people, like what we mentioned in the previous episode as well, al-mulku yabqa ma'al kufr wa la yabqa ma'al dhulm. These governments will not stay with this oppression. They will eventually be annihilated, right? And when the people take their deserving place in controlling the governments, that's when we will see the true face of the majority of the Arabs and the Muslims when it comes to Israel. So the governments, yes, they might recognize one or two. They might even give relations. They might even have diplomatic missions, in one or two of these countries. But the people are completely against that. Majority of the people, not only the Muslims in the region, but many of the non-Muslims are also against this because it's oppression.
Yeah.
I also believe it's a deserving point to mention that the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, he recently, or in a few instances recently, he mentioned that we are in a turning point of history. And this turning point is shifting different powers of the world. Like the U.S., it's slowly losing the power that it had previously in the world, right? Likewise, Israel is the same, right? The power it had in the region before, and with all the cunning and the treacherous ways it was able to recognize itself and bless itself with legitimacy in alliance with the powers of the region, or at least I should say the governments of the region, now is losing that. There are many countries who are now slowly moving back to the first initial notion that Israel should not be recognized.
Mm-hmm.
Slowly, by, you know, steps by step, in a very slow pace. But then eventually, like we mentioned, it's the promise of God. Israel will definitely be annihilated, and there will be no such government as Israel in the very near future, inshallah.
And they will not benefit from their normalization of the ties with Israel, definitely, because they were they tried to compensate a part of their, economy Because some of these countries were under the economic pressures, they wanted to compensate with the promises that Jared Kushner gave them.
Yeah.
So definitely they will not reach that, because this is like the wheat of the city of Ray that we all know about the story for the Umar ibn Sa'd, that Imam Ali Salam told him, this is the wheat of the city of Ray, that you will never ever reach it.
The funny thing is, the city of Ray itself is losing its own wheat at the moment. U.S. itself, the economy, as we mentioned, the three banks have recently went bankrupt. And the funny thing is, they're losing their own economy. The global recession caused by the U.S. dollars is
okay. Let's think and let's imagine that they actually are joining America, and they are actually depending themselves on America and Israel in their own golden economic time. Okay, so let's just with a simple analogy, we want to ask the statesmen of these countries: have you ever seen any country? That became prosperous with the help of America on the scene of the earth? I mean, their economy flourished in a way that they had all their own independence, and they actually and they find themselves in the best way and the wealth of health and wealth of wealth.
Let's give some examples: Afghanistan, Iraq.
Yeah.
Oh no, I'm sorry. They never found perspective.
So these are the countries that America went in order to make them prosperous.
Yeah.
So in case they are, wise and they have wisdom to think about these issues, they can easily reach to this conclusion that this will go nowhere.
Exactly. So as you mentioned something really beautiful, the people and the government are some two different actually things. But as you know, in our Islamic revolution, the people and the leadership of Imam Khomeini was exactly in the same road, in the same path, in the same boat. And the thing here is, despite the announcement and beautiful warnings of Imam Khomeini and other leaderships here, we still have some negligence from the Muslim people here. And one of the ways of abusing this negligence from Israel and some, Zionist regimes is normalization. So could you please elaborate this issue more for us, Brother Ali?
Yeah. This negligence is a threat for the Muslims, because as soon as Muslims got negligent on their issues, they lose, and they lost even their identity and even their proud and their wealth. We have seen the case in the Battle of Uhud. Those who were with the Holy Prophet, they were all Muslims, and they knew that there is a divine leader there and who is leading them. And he's actually directly taking the orders from God, but they did not listen to what the leader of the Islamic Ummah was saying. Actually, here I'm not going to compare the Holy Prophet with the leader of the Islamic Ummah. No, I want just to reach to this conclusion that this negligence is very bad, because as far as we neglect the threat of the enemy, we believe that we can conquer, we can defeat the enemy, and we got this proud, this false pride in us. So this is the time that we have collapsed, and this is the time that we are defeated. So we have to be careful. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in Al-Quran, it says, وَدَّ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا لَوْ تَغْفُلُونَ عَنْ أَسْلَحَتِكُمْ وَأَمْتِعَتِكُمْ فَيَمِيلُونَ عَلَيْكُمْ مَيْلَةً وَاحِدَةً. The enemy wants you to become negligent for a single moment. Then from that negligent moment and second, he will beat you on the back. You see? So we have to be careful. When we are seeing, the vivid cases of the fruits of this normalization, when we see the clear outcome of the entrance of America and Israel in the countries that they entered earlier, and when we can make a good judgment, so what is the necessity of that to even think about that? So this is the same thing that the Holy Prophet was telling them. Listen to me. Then they started to fight among themselves. Muslims were fighting among tanazatum. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Watanazatum." فشلتم وتنازعتم. That is, they started, I mean, to be abusive toward each other in order to be, I mean, harsh toward the enemy. So why should we get involved and get busy with ourselves?
Exactly.
So when we know the enemy, the common enemy, the enemy is quite clear. And we know that, I mean, the experience shows that the way that they entered in any country, at least others should, we have some lessons to take from others, not to become a lesson for others again.
You see, the enemy feeds on our negligence, on the negligence of the Muslims. And you'd sometimes be surprised that some of the biggest incidents of the world, whether it be a pandemic or whether it be a disease, and a disease that is outreaching everywhere, something that, whether it be some entertainment that is booming, they use this in the media, they bowl this in the media to forget what's, to make sure, to hide what's happening in the occupied territories. You'd be surprised that sometimes when this FIFA football competitions take place, at the same time there is some oppression going on in the palace in the occupied territories. And the way out of this is to see what's behind the curtains. The Muslims should be united and see what's behind the curtains. There are many things hidden in front of us, and they try to make it hidden. The enemy has this power of media.
Exactly.
They turn the good to bad and bad to good, right? And they, if they can't do that, they hide what is good at least. And once it's hidden behind the curtains, we don't know. That's why you see many of these, sometimes even the Muslims, we also mentioned in the previous episodes as well, they believe, okay, negotiations might even solve this issue. Whereas if you go look into the Palestinian territories, if they have the first-hand look, they will know that there is no such thing as negotiation.
They're negotiating for more than 60 years.
Yeah, there is no such thing as negotiation. You see, negotiation is when you sit down at a table and then you have equal power and you say, you take this, I take that, we accept this and you accept that. There is no negotiation. When you come to a table, what they say, okay, look, you take this, that's it. You take this, that's it.
Yeah.
Well, this is not called negotiation. No one says they call this negotiation. There must be some form of give and take in negotiation. That's why they use this word negotiation. They use this, you know, different slogans in the media, and they hide what's behind the curtains. And unfortunately, the Palestinian people, they don't have this power of media. Now, alhamdulillah, slowly, after the Islamic Revolution and the power that was given to the resistance force, alhamdulillah, now many people who were ignorant about what's going on, they know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But then still, they pray over the ignorance. They pray, and they use this tool, media, to hide what's behind the curtain.
So, you told me, there is some conclusions for this negligence from the Muslim countries and Muslim world.
Mm.
And you know what? Tell me the end of this story. You know what? There should be an end for this oppression, for everything, and a win for the better part. What do you think about the end of the story of Zionism, Israel, and so on?
Definitely, the end is quite clear. Allah's promises, as the brother read the verse, وَنَرِيدَ عَنَّمُنَّ الَّذِينَ صَدَقُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَنَجْعَلُهُمْ أَئِمَّةً وَنَجْعَلُهُمُ الْوَارِثِينَ. At the end of the day, the righteous will be the inhabitant of the earth and the leaders of the earth. Definitely, there is no doubt on that.
Beautiful.
But the prediction that the leader of the Islamic Ummah made, that he said some 5 years ago, that Israel will not see its 25th years of existence from now, I think it will happen definitely. And even I can say, I myself, based on the studies that I have on the scene, I think it is even earlier and sooner. Because we are seeing now the races of such a collapse, and hopefully it will happen. But a word to those who are inside or outside the country, and they might criticize, I mean, the kind of policy or stance that Islamic Republic is taking. I think we have to tell the brothers and sisters who are listening and at least have a word to say, we have to tell them, look, the kind of war is different now. I mean, it's true, we are in a war. I mean, the existence of Israel in the region is a war against us. I mean, whether we like it or not, it is a war. But the kind of war differs. I mean, yes, we need to stop it from the way it is. I mean, stop it from the place it is. And we have done it. I mean, we have done the cautious, we have done the precautions in the right time. But there are some people who are sensitive, that they think that this is just an illusion. But we see the reality, the way that they started to ruin Lebanon, to ruin Syria, to ruin Iraq, to reach to the borders of Iran. So this was something that from the first day we understood. And I want to tell them to study the realities and to see and study the realities and to check even the Islamic history, when Imam Ali al-Islam says, "Man nama lam yunam an." If you get a slip in the battlefront, you will waken up by the kick of the enemy.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Brother Ali and Brother Muhammad, for your presence in this discussion. So let me again tell this beautiful quote that oppression will not last long, as we all know that. And one day, the beautiful truth of Allah will shine brighter than today in this world. Thank you for listening to us. It was all the time we had for today's episode. And I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. No father to wipe away my tears. That's why I will cry. I feel scared, but I won't show my fears. I keep my head high, deep in my heart. I never have any doubt. The Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
International Monetary Fund, IMF, has warned that the world economy is facing its weakest period of growth since 1990s in the next 5 years due to problems triggered by the pandemic and political tensions around the world. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. We'll be right back. According to Bloomberg, the International Monetary Fund has warned that its outlook for global economic growth over the next 5 years is the weakest in more than three decades, urging nations to avoid economic fragmentation caused by geopolitical tension and take steps to bolster productivity. The emergency lender sees the world economy expanding about 3% over the next half decade as higher interest rates bite. Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva said in a speech in Washington recently, "That's the lowest medium-term growth forecast since 1990 and less than the five-year average of 3.8% from the past two decades. For 2023, global gross domestic product, GDP, will likely expand by less than 3%," she said. That's in line with the fund's January forecast of 2.9%. About 90% of advanced economies will see growth slow this year, as tighter monetary policy weighs on demand and slows economic activity in the U.S. and euro area, the IMF said. It plans to release a more detailed World Economic Outlook report on April 11th as part of its spring meetings held together with the World Bank. Georgieva said in a Bloomberg television interview with Tom Kinn, "The world economy as a whole is now less able to support the weakest members. Why? The peace dividend is gone. Some emerging markets are showing strength, particularly in Asia, with India and China expected to account for half of global expansion. But low-income nations are hamstrung by weakening demand for their exports, with their per capita income growth remaining below that of the emerging economies. Poverty and hunger that increased during the coronavirus pandemic could climb. Despite the bleak growth outlook, high inflation means that central banks must continue to raise interest rates as long as financial stability pressures remain limited after recent banking industry upheaval in the U.S. and Switzerland," Georgieva said. "If the banking system becomes unstable, policymakers will face more complicated trade-offs between inflation and the safeguarding the financial system," Georgieva added. "Be vigilant and more agile than ever." Policymakers are set to converge in Washington for sessions focused on numerous global challenges, from unsustainable debt in developing nations to inflation to climate change. Georgieva said in her speech, "With rising geopolitical tensions, with inflation still running high, a robust recovery remains elusive. That harms the prospects of everyone, especially for the most vulnerable people and most vulnerable countries." Georgieva's stark message comes a day after the IMF warned that geopolitical fragmentation driven by tensions between the U.S. and China risks damaging the global economy, with foreign direct investment and other capital increasingly being channeled toward aligned blocs of countries. She repeated a warning from January that longer-term trade fragmentation, including restrictions on migration, capital flows, and international cooperation, could cut global gross domestic product by as much as 7%, equivalent to the combined annual output of Germany and Japan, or about $7 trillion. Interruptions to technology trade could see losses as large as 12% of GDP for some countries, Georgieva said. She said in the television interview, "Getting on a path of less fragmentation in the world economy is good for everybody." Meanwhile, RT noted, "The world economy is facing its weakest period of growth since 1990s in the next 5 years due to problems triggered by the pandemic and political tensions. a severe slowdown in the global economy last year following the COVID-19 pandemic. And the conflict in Ukraine is set to continue in 2023 and could persist for the next 5 years, Georgieva warned. Global GDP will grow at about 3% over the next half decade compared to an average of 3.8% seen in the past 20 years, representing the worst economic performance in more than three decades. The IMF expects global GDP to expand by less than 3% this year, which is in line with its January projection of 2.9%. Last year, global growth almost halved following an initial post-pandemic rebound in 2021, sliding from 6.1% to 3.4%, Georgieva said, ahead of the IMF World Economic Outlook report, which is due to be released very soon in the future. Up to 90% of advanced economies are likely to experience a decline in their growth rate this year, she warned, with activity in the US and the Eurozone hit by higher interest rates. Georgieva said, with rising geopolitical tensions, with inflation still running high, a robust recovery remains elusive. That harms the prospects of everyone, especially for the most vulnerable people and most vulnerable countries. The IMF head warned against economic fragmentation stemming from geopolitical tensions and urged countries to take action to boost global productivity. According to IMF, soaring inflation facing most of the world's wealthy nations will force central banks to continue interest rate hikes, adding pressure to the banking industry despite financial uncertainty following recent turmoil with lenders in the US and Switzerland. She urged the world community to be vigilant, more agile than ever, adding that regulators may come across more complicated choices to protect the financial system amid persistent inflation and challenges in the banking sector. Long-term disintegration in global trade, such as restrictions on capital flows and international cooperation, as well as curbs on migration, could slash global GDP by up to 7% or $7 trillion, which is the equivalent of the combined annual production of Germany and Japan, IMF warned.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.